Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, February 14th, 2020 edition of the News Gazette. Happy Valentine's Day. And we'll start on the front page with a piece about the Michael Henslick trial, Day 3, called Something Was Just Coming Over Me. Closing arguments set today after jury hears suspect's record confession. By Mary Shank, Urbana. Attorneys for Holly Cassano's accused murderer rested their case Thursday without calling any witnesses on Michael Henslick's behalf after prosecutors delivered their final blows, his recorded confession and DNA tying him to the crime. Asked by Judge Heidi Ladd if he understood that the decision of whether to testify was his alone, Henslick said he did and that he chose not to. The case will go to the jury late this morning after closing arguments. Jurors must determine guilt or innocence, and if they find him guilty, must then decide if the acts were performed in a brutal and heinous manner, indicative of wanton cruelty. Should they make that finding, Henslick, 31, will spend the rest of his life behind bars for a crime he could not explain. The final witness for the prosecution was Illinois State Crime Laboratory scientist Dana Pitchford, a 23-year employee who had worked on the fatal stabbing of a 22-year-old Holly Cassano since it happened in 2009. Forensic biologist with a specialty in DNA, Pitchford testified that she obtained DNA profiles from 8 of the many pieces of evidence collected after Ms. Cassano's slain body was found November 2, 2009, in the bedroom of her Mahomet mobile home. Forensic pathologist Dr. Scott Denton concluded that Ms. Cassano died from internal bleeding caused by several of the estimated 55 to 60 stab wounds that he said were likely inflicted by a kitchen steak knife. Graphic crime scene photos shown to the jury revealed a lot of blood on her, in her bedroom, and throughout her home, the latter suggesting that the assailant was also injured and left a trail of blood behind. Pitchford extracted DNA from several pieces of that collected evidence, a bloody light switch cover from her bathroom, dried blood from the floor at the opposite end of her home, blood on the wall and door handle of the spare bedroom, blood on the knob of the front door, blood on the storm door, and semen recovered from her. The DNA from all those, she said, came from one man. From 2009 to 2018, when Henslick was arrested, Pitchford said she compared the DNA developed from the evidence to the DNA deputies had collected from 190 other men, all of whom were excluded as contributors. Michael Henslick is included as a contributor, Pitchford said, reciting the statistical value that the chances that the semen in Ms. Cassano and the blood on the evidence came from someone else are 1 in 150 octillion. That's 150 plus 27 zeros. Likewise, two other samples of blood from her thigh and her knee were linked to Henslick, Pitchford testified. Denton said Ms. Cassano had no stab wounds on her legs, but he found blood on her lower body that was likely deposited by her killer when he cut himself while stabbing her. Henslick. Sex consensual. After his arrest about 6:15 p.m. August 28, 2018, Henslick was driven to the sheriff's office on East Main Street in Urbana, where he was questioned by two detectives for about 5 hours in an 8-by-10-foot room that had a 3-by-3-foot table. About 3.5 hours into what was initially an unproductive interview, he admitted he killed Ms. Cassano by stabbing her all over in a fit of rage. But he never gave the frustrated investigators a reason that made any sense to them. Investigator Dwayne Rolfs involved in the case from the day of the killing was with Hentschel for the entire interview, portions of which were played for the jury. After Judge Heidi Ladd declined to suppress the statement in its entirety, rejecting the defense suggested that it was coerced, the lawyers edited into sections that they agreed the jury should hear. Those 7 excerpts ranged in length from about a minute to 70 minutes. It was the 70-minute portion of his statement for which jurors had a transcript, in which an often unintelligible Hentschel eventually admitted to Ralph's and fellow detective Chris Darr, he stabbed Miss Cassano all over, pointing to his torso. Hentschel told the detectives he went to her house about 3:30 or 4 a.m. on November 2, 2009. He said he had been there about 2 weeks earlier with Amber Nakashian, Miss Cassano's cousin. "I just walked in," he said, adding Miss Cassano was in her kitchen, startled when he entered through the unlocked front door. He told her he wanted to talk about Amber, with whom he had a thing, but also admitted he had a little interest with Holly, too. I mean, it was just the whole love triangle thing that was all messed up. While talking about Amber, Hentschel said he and Miss Cassano did have sex. And that just kind of made things seem crazier, with the whole thing being interested in Amber and Amber having a boyfriend, he said, maintaining that the sex was consensual. An unconscious decision. Hentschel said they both fell asleep, she in her bed and he on the floor. When he woke, he went to the kitchen and got a steak knife from the counter. "I was like in a funny, weird place in my head, still kind of drunk. And, well, just the whole Amber thing, just life, and whatnot. You know, I had potentially thought of hurting myself. And the next thing you know, it was an unconscious decision. Unconscious thing, like taking over me." Pressed by Darr for details, Hentschel said Miss Cassano was sleeping when he began stabbing her. "I think she might have said something like, 'What?' and 'Help,'" he said, adding he didn't know how many times he stabbed her. "And when she had died, he had sex with her on the floor, something he later admitted was disgusting to think about. I left her there. I know she was there on her back. She was sprawled out. That's what I remember." Hentschel said he cut his left inside forearm while stabbing her and went through the house looking for something to clean himself with, eventually finding a piece of clothing. He drove away and said he tossed the knife out the window just down the road. Ralph said investigators never found it. Pressed by the investigators for why he killed a woman who had just willingly had sex with him, Hentschel said he had asked himself that. He denied being angry with her, despite Darr's suggestion that 67 stab wounds smacked of rage. "Like I said, something was just coming over me, you know," Hentschel said. "I think I was just angry about it all, the whole Amber and I thing, and just being scared, hurt, afraid, and then just raged and blinded by a multitude of emotions," adding he was more emotional than drunk, despite having consumed hard liquor and beer earlier. In answer to other questions, Hentschel said he never killed anyone else, didn't ever tell anyone about killing Miss Cassano, and was remorseful for what he had done, but unwilling to turn himself in. "I was afraid. I wanted to have a life, like growing up and, you know, having my house, being financially stable, having a family." There was no reason. Darr and Ralphs asked Hentschel repeatedly why he killed Miss Cassano, saying that what he had told them did not make sense and appealing to him to give answers to her grieving mother. After Hensluck's admissions, Darr left the interview room briefly for fresh air. Hentschel had smoked at least 6 cigarettes during the 70 minutes jurors saw of his interview and drank only 1 bottle of water in the 5 hours he was in the room. Ralphs continued to press him for a reason. "There was no reason. I don't even know myself, really," Henslick said. Dark came back a couple minutes later, and he and Ralph tried one last time to get Henslick to say why he would have violently killed a woman who had just had sex with him. "This is the way Michael wants the public to hear it? Is that you killed Holly because you were jealous, you were enraged, you were emotional, and she took the brunt of all that?" Dar asked. "And you had consensual sex, right? That's really what you want people to believe," Ralph said. "That's the way it went down?" Dar said. "That is the way it went down," Henslick replied. "Yeah, good luck with that," Ralph replied. "It doesn't make sense at all. It's never made sense to me," Henslick said. And the next piece is about champagne liquor laws. City looking at lowering fines. Council member, they're outsized. By Ben Zigerman, Champagne. Students can go to campus town bars when they're 19. But if they get caught drinking, they could be fined up to $700 if they use a fake ID. The city puts certain alcohol-related ordinance violations, such as underage drinking and using a fake ID, in its highest tier of offenses, for which the fine is $350. At this week's city council meeting, several council members said those fines are too high and instructed staff to adjust them for consideration at a future meeting. "We'll let you go to the bar when you're 19, but don't drink while you're there. We want you to go to the bar. We want you to go to the bars and not go to a party because you're safer in the bars," District 4 Representative Greg Stock said. "The hypocrisy is a lot." He compared it to middle-tier ordinance violations like battery, retail theft, and damaging property that are fined at $255. "The 19-year-old kid drinking a beer in a bar is not as serious to me as somebody who's damaging property or battering someone," Stock said. "So I think that those are a little offline to what they ought to be." I don't know what the magic number is, but I think that to make those the most serious fine sounds a little bit more like a money grab than it does actually protecting the community, in my mind, Stock said. In fiscal 2019, the city collected $635,971 in fines, which staff noted is less than 1% of the city's general revenue fund. Champaign does not use fines as a significant source of revenue to make up the city budget, staff wrote in a report to council. At-large council member Matthew Gladney also spoke in favor of lowering the underage alcohol fines. "These are people who can vote, and these are people who can serve in the armed forces. But if they get caught with alcohol or purchasing alcohol or trying to buy cannabis, they get this $350 fine," he said. "Meanwhile, animal cruelty and assault and battery has a nearly $100 less of a fine. That makes no sense to me." District 2 Representative Alicia Beck said it didn't make sense for violations such as animal cruelty, assault, fighting, and battery to be at the lower $255 level. "I think that those are worthy of a $350 fine," she said. District 5 Representative Vanna Pianfetti expressed concern with certain fines, calling them out of whack in some ways. "Conceivably, we have a $700 fine on a minor," Pianfetti said. "I'm not sure a student is going to come up with $350 in 21 days or $700. District 3 Representative Angie Bricks called the fines a little steep and said she'd support giving people more time to pay them. In the past 3 years, 840 of the 863 people, or 97%, fined for fake IDs have paid their fines within 21 days, avoiding court. And 995 of the 1,052 people, or 96%, fined for underage drinking, paid their fine within 21 days. If a case goes to court, The city said its legal staff generally puts in five times the resources compared to processing a fine payment. There are more than 120 types of ordinance violations, which the city has put into three tiers of fines, $205, $255, and $350, along with a unique $50 fine for marijuana possession that was reduced in 2018 from $350. The City Council established the fines in 1988 as a way to settle an ordinance violation without going to court. The council initially set the maximum tier at $125, increasing it in 1994 to $500 and 2 years later to $750. In 1997, the council lowered the maximum tier to $205 with an automatic $10 increase every 2 years that is currently on hold until July 1st. Mayor Deb Finan said she was generally on board with the other council members' comments and also suggested lowering the fine for public possession of alcohol from $350 to $50. "You have a 21-year-old individual as council member," Tom Bruno would say if he was here, carrying a beer across the street to visit his neighbor's barbecue, "and it's a $350 fine," Finan said. "That makes no sense to me in the face of the other ones that were listed." And next, a piece from Illinois Football, "Illini Eyes Already Focused on Ireland" by Bob Asmussen. With kickoff still another 561 days away, pregame preparations are already taking place for Illinois Football's 2021 date in Dublin. A UI advanced team is in the Irish capital this week, ironing out some of the details of the Illini's August 28, 2021 game against Nebraska at 51,700-seat Aviva Stadium. The Illinois travel party includes Deputy Athletic Director Warren Hood, Senior Associate AD Marty Kaufman, Assistant AD Bobby Busboom, and Director of Football Operations Tim Knox. Though the game isn't for another year and a half, there are logistical questions to solve around lodging, pregame activities, and the setup at the stadium. Nebraska athletic spokesman Keith Mann said the school hasn't yet sent an advance team to Ireland, but will soon. Illinois will send another group for this year's Notre Dame-Navy game in Dublin on August 29th. Currently, tickets for the Ireland game are available only through tour packages with costs ranging from $2,000 to $5,000 per person. The Illinois fans that want to go probably need to start making some decisions soon if they want their choice of hotels and some other packages that go along with that, Illinois athletic spokesman Kent Brown said. While Illinois has never played outside the U.S., it will be Nebraska's second overseas game. In 1992, the Cornhuskers played Kansas State in Tokyo. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called "Celebrity Justice." Cook County's leading prosecutor thought a criminal case involving an alleged phony hate crime was dead and buried, but remarkably, it's been resurrected. Cook County politics is frequently entertaining, even more frequently unappetizing, but rarely more so than this week when a court-appointed special prosecutor adopted the role of skunk at a garden party hosted by Democratic Party bosses. Playing the role of skunk was Chicago lawyer Dan Webb, who announced the re-indictment of Empire actor Jussie Smollett for the alleged fake hate crime he orchestrated in January 2019 when he told police that he was physically attacked by racist and homophobic supporters of President Donald Trump. From the beginning, Smollett's story didn't add up. He claimed, for example, that he fought off his attackers while holding a cell phone in one hand and a sandwich in the other. But the national news media brought his version of events hook, line, and sinker before the extensive police investigation showed it never happened. Evidence indicated Smollett allegedly hired two acquaintances to fake the assault so that Smollett, for reasons known only to him, could play the role of sympathetic victim and political martyr. Once this subterfuge became known, public outrage ensued, and Smollett was indicted on multiple charges of disorderly conduct. What followed was even more farcical. The Cook County State's Attorney's Office dropped all the charges against him in March 2019, as clear a case of favorable treatment for a high-profile defendant as one can find. State's Attorney Kim Fox gave multiple lame explanations for her actions, but ultimately took responsibility for a poor decision while rejecting blame. The irony continued to abound after Webb's announcement. Just as Smollett blamed the fictitious attack on Trump, so too did Fox blame Trump, indirectly, for the action by Webb. It can only be interpreted as a further politicization of the justice system, something voters in the era of Donald Trump should consider offensive, Fox said. The indictment could have significant political ramifications because Fox, who is extremely close to County Party Chairwoman Tony Preckwinkle, is running for re-election in the March 17th Democratic primary. Her opponents, naturally, leaped at the opportunity to argue her unfitness for office. The re-indictment never would have happened if a retired state appellate court justice, Sheila O'Brien, hadn't petitioned the courts for the appointment of a special prosecutor to re-examine the case. After weeks of legal maneuvering, Judge Michael Tooman appointed Webb to determine whether Smollett should be prosecuted for the alleged staged hate crime. Further, he directed Webb to determine if the decision by the state's attorney's office was the result of criminal wrongdoing. While announcing that he has reached no conclusions on the issue of wrongdoing within the state's attorney's office, Webb said it is in the interest of justice that Smollett be recharged. He said the case against Smollett is justified because of the extensive nature of Mr. Smollett's false police reports and the resources expended by the Chicago Police Department to investigate these false reports. For his part, Smollett continues to deny any impropriety. His lawyer expressed outrage over the charges, contending they were appropriately dismissed the first time because they were not supported by the evidence. If that is the case, his lawyer will have the opportunity to demonstrate her client's innocence. While this is a high-profile case, it is not a big case in the traditional sense, with one exception. Fox's original decision to dismiss this case stands as a stark example of what many see as a dual system of justice. One for regular folks and another for those with some kind of clout, whether it be through politics or celebrity contacts. That's why Webb's decision to hold Smollett accountable for his actions is a good one. If his action gives voters a reason to reconsider whether Fox deserves another 4-year term in office, so much the better. And now in the From Our Readers section, here's a piece by Laura Keller of Champaign called No Legal Deadline on ERA Adoption. The News Gazette's editorial board has once again dismissed the importance of the Equal Rights Amendment and insulted its supporters with its February 4th editorial. It characterized Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul's filing of a federal lawsuit with Nevada and Virginia to force recognition of the ERA as an attempt to sow some political hay from an ambitious political wannabe. It called out ERA supporters as enthusiastic but credulous. According to it, a legal mountain is about to be made of a constitutional molehill. Worse, however, is the editorial's declaration that women are already seen as equal before the law via the Constitution's 14th Amendment. I am not an attorney, but many who are would disagree. The Supreme Court has interpreted the amendment differently when considering sex discrimination versus claims of racial or religious discrimination. Justice Antony Scalia said, "Certainly the Constitution does not require discrimination on the basis of sex. The only issue is whether it's prohibited it. It doesn't. If the ERA is simply duplicative, one has to wonder about the reasons for opposition. Supporters are enthusiastic, and we are the majority. We are not credulous. We know that change is difficult. It took almost a century to pass the 19th Amendment, giving women the vote. It has already been 97 years since the ERA was first proposed. We will use the courts, the legislature, the power of the public opinion. If need be, we will start over. There can be no deadline on equality." And that again was written by Laura Keller of Champaign. The next piece is written by Joseph Bowers of Champaign called "Trump, Pelosi Are on Same Page." Nancy Pelosi tore up Donald Trump's State of the Union speech. What leadership! She showed him. So how does her contempt for Trump carry over to contempt for his policies? Not so much. When Trump seeks in excess of $700 billion for his defense budget, way more than the next several countries combined, she's on board. When he seeks to renew the draconian Patriot Act that infringes on citizens' rights, she's right there with him. When he institutes trade policies that hurt the American worker, no problem. When he acknowledges a Venezuelan pretender to its presidency who received no votes in their election, she applauds this man and the foreign policy it represents. When he imposes sanctions that hurt only the people of certain foreign countries, she is happy to oblige. When he endorses endless American wars, she endorses them too. Pelosi, estimated personal wealth of $120 million, is typical of American politics today. The Republicans, once the party of Lincoln, are now the party of Trump and all that entails. The Democrats, once the party of the New Deal, are now hell-bent on cheating their most popular candidate out of their presidential nomination. So, if you seek a party of the people or an anti-war party, forget about it. What we have now are two parties that serve the super-rich exclusively. Elections exist only to see which of these rapacious groups can secure the best feeding place at the public trough. And that again was written by Joseph Bowers of Champaign. And the last piece is written by Peggy Patton of Urbana, "Emperor Trump Without Clothes." Instead of providing an accurate portrait of the State of the Union in his speech, President Trump used this year's address to mislead the public. Trump claimed that the U.S. is respected around the world. According to U.S. News and World Report, trust in the U.S. has dropped by more than 50% since 2016, the sharpest drop of any country assessed. Trump claimed he will always protect patients with pre-existing conditions when, according to PolitiFact, he has taken multiple steps to weaken or eliminate current pre-existing protections. Trump claimed the cost of prescription drugs went down for the first time in 51 years when, according to Kaiser Health News, drug prices have not come down. Trump claimed our economy is the best it has ever been. According to Business Insider, the president's economic record is mixed in part due to the massive federal deficits accrued from Trump's tax cuts and the uncertainty resulting from Trump's trade disputes. The address included many more falsehoods. Sadly, we have become accustomed to the president's habitual lying. He had only been in the office a few hours when he lied about the size of his Inauguration Day crowd. According to independent fact-checkers, Trump has made over 15,000 false or misleading claims since becoming president. Trump lies because he can. No one stops him. I respect Senator Mitt Romney's courage in acknowledging Trump's abuse of power. When will the rest of the Republican Party expose the president as the emperor with no clothes? And that again was written by Peggy Patton of Urbana. And we'll take a short break now and continue with the second half hour of the Friday, February 14th, 2020 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.